Hello, I'm Nick Clark. This is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, drought, poverty and conflict have left millions of people starving in Africa. The continent's food insecurity has been made worse by the war in Ukraine. How can another hunger crisis be averted? Also this week, employment grew more than expected in the US, and the president says the job market is robust. But tech companies have been laying off workers, so what's behind the mixed signals? A new billionaire was created every 30 hours over the last 2 years, while millions of people have fallen into extreme poverty. Now, as inflation soars, could the inequality gap widen even more? 346 million Africans, that's more than a quarter of the continent's people, are suffering hunger because of conflict, drought and poverty. Now a war that's thousands of kilometres away is threatening to make Africa's food insecurity crisis worse. Grain supplies are disrupted and the prices of staples and fuel are skyrocketing. The head of the African Union warns that risks a catastrophic scenario of food shortages, and he's urged Russia and the West to help ease the situation. Kyiv and Western capitals blame Moscow for blocking Ukraine's exports and triggering a supply shortage. Putin denies the accusations. The Russian foreign minister has guaranteed the safety of grain shipments from Ukraine if Kyiv removes naval mines and Western nations lift their sanctions. Ukraine says Russia is demanding unreasonable conditions. The announcement came after Sergei Lavrov held talks in Turkey as part of a UN plan to get a deal in place between Moscow and Kyiv. More than 40% of Africa's wheat comes from Russia and Ukraine, and now the price has gone up by 45% as a result of the supply disruption. The cost of fertilizer has increased too by at least 300%. The African Development Bank says that could lead to a 20% decline in Africa's food production. The organization has pledged more than $1.5 billion to provide farmers with seeds and other aid. Chad, a landlocked country in West Africa, has recently declared a food emergency as the region suffers its worst food crisis in a decade. And in the Horn of Africa, the UN warns more than 14 million people are on the brink of starvation in an area experiencing its worst drought in 40 years. In Somalia, more than 800,000 people have left the countryside to seek help in camps, having lost their animals and crops. Malcolm Webb has this report.
When two of Abdullahi Bule Khairo's children died of hunger and thirst, he says he was left with no choice. He abandoned the only life he's ever known as a nomadic herder. He says he was caught between the armed group Al-Shabaab and worsening drought. Most of his goats and cows perished. He told us he left the last animals to die and walked with his surviving daughter, Fardosa, for 3 weeks to reach here, a camp for displaced people in the port city of Kismayo in Somalia.
My wife lost her mind with grief. That was after we were unable to get food for our children. The last I heard, she tried to walk to Mogadishu. I don't have the strength to look for her. I don't have shelter. I don't have anything to eat. I have nothing.
Abdullahi and Fardosa have joined thousands of people already in this camp. Many of them lost their animals in previous droughts and haven't been able to restock their herds. More than half of Somalis depend on herding. Livestock turn dry scrub into milk and meat that people have survived on for thousands of years. But the droughts are becoming more frequent and worse. So the camps in cities like Kismayo grow bigger. Many of the people here may never go back. Abdullahi Muhammad says he would never have dreamt of eating fish when he was a herder. Then his sheep and goats were wiped out in a drought 5 years ago. He says he then struggled to survive in a camp in Kismayo until the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization bought him a boat and trained him to fish.
There's a big difference. As a livestock keeper, life is always about struggling with drought and trying to recover from it. To fish in the ocean, you have to learn many things. The ocean itself is like a university. You need to study how it works.
Abdullahi spent years learning and says he can now get a good catch 5 days a week. Says the money he earns is enough to pay school fees for his children. The UN says many more people could be helped in the same way.
The IDP crisis is also becoming an urbanization crisis, and it requires a more durable solution by supporting the fisheries sector, which has a huge potential where they can diversify and improve their food security, livelihood and nutrition as well.
It's not clear how the millions of Somalis in the countryside will survive in a warmer world or what they'll eat. Maybe Somalia's 3,000-kilometre coastline and its fish can help. Malcolm Webb, Al Jazeera, Kismayo, Somalia.
Well, joining us from Cape Town in South Africa is Dr. Peter Terence Jacobs. He's the acting strategic lead in the Inclusive Economic Development Division at the Human Sciences Research Council. Dr. Jacobs, welcome to the programme. So talks to ease Ukraine's grain supply, they haven't achieved much. Can there be a breakthrough, do you think?
Well, at this stage, the diplomatic stalemate will probably continue for a while. Obviously, the concerns for us in Africa, across the continent, continues to be not only on the diplomatic side, but more on the humanitarian side, because the humanitarian impact, especially in terms of hunger, food and nutrition security, has been a big concern. And we do hope that the diplomatic breakthrough will come sooner rather than later. But thus far, the stalemate continues.
I'm wondering just how much of a difference it would make anyway, given the various other factors that are affecting food supply in Africa.
You are spot on, because what we are having here is a situation of what I refer to as the trade-off between decline in agri-food production capacity, in other words, the capabilities of Africa to produce its own food. And as that declines, there has been an increasing, or at least over the last 30, 40 years, an increasing reliance on trade and aid. And here, as a result of the spillover effects of the war, we have seen the impact quite severely on both sides. So on the decline of agricultural production capacity, obviously we've got a number of different factors impacting on our ability to produce our own food. I think the first one is obviously the climatic catastrophes, the severe ecological changes that are happening. In addition to that, of course, we've got the other two big factors playing a role. Sociopolitical conflicts in certain parts of the region and certain parts of the continent that have really devastated the ability to produce enough food, distribute food, and food distribution and production systems have also been impacted by armed conflicts across the continent. So it's this combination of factors that we've got to take into consideration and focus on when we look at the food and nutrition security
right.
situation across the continent.
So just spiraling back to the situation in Ukraine at the moment, so the West are accusing Russia of weaponizing food supply, and clearly it's important that that food supply situation is resolved, as we've already discussed. But do you think that is the case, that Russia is using food as a weapon?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at this, whether you look at it from the side of the West or if you look at it from the side of poorer countries. And I think this was supposedly inevitable given the changing nature of the war there. Whether or not, I think that is indeed the objective and goal of Moscow to have it as a weapon in the fuller kind of scale of meeting its own objectives. That's very, very difficult for us to
right.
decide at this particular stage of the evolution of the conflict there.
Okay, well, the African Union chief, Macky Sall, he's complained that sanctions have made it difficult to buy grains from Russia. He has a point, doesn't he?
Yes, but at the same time, the conflict has had spillover effects, indeed, on the humanitarian side. And if countries that are heavily impacted on what is referred to as trade and aid, those are countries that are severely affected. But countries that are not heavily affected by that might not be. Here, for example, if we look at parts of the continent, specifically Tunisia and Egypt, where there's heavy reliance on grain imports from those countries, that is indeed going to be the case. But there's been other spillover effects on export restrictions by countries that have also got grain production capacity, especially big, very, very big countries, such as India, for example. And we're all aware of that, that these countries have all imposed severe restrictions in order to protect the food security situation of their own countries and to deal with other, emergency food situations that they might be confronted with. So I'm not too sure whether it's only the war itself, but there are other factors, I think, that we've got to take into consideration in this particular case.
Okay. And what about on the ground? I mean, aid is one thing, isn't it? But what can be done by governments on the ground in terms of diversifying food supplies, like fisheries and so forth? What other long-term solutions can be found within Africa?
Well, the first thing would be to explore more carefully what we refer to today as climate smart transitions in the agri-food value chain. That means introducing and scaling up new ways of agricultural production, diversifying the capacity to have climate smart agricultural production techniques, production techniques that are ecologically more sustainable. I think that would be a key investment for Africa at this stage. But that, would be a longer term transition. It will take 10 or more years for Africa to begin to scale that up. So in the short and medium term, I think we've got to explore the varieties of different areas of social protection, both social protection that will enable people to get access to food and more indirect social protection forms to get access to food. Ecological transition of agriculture would be a much longer term prospect, but I think the immediate areas of investment, scaling up social protection and scaling up the public sector support for agricultural production.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Thank you, sir, for joining us. Dr. Jacob speaking to us from Cape Town.
Much appreciated. Take care.
Now, the health of the labour market in the world's largest economy is being watched closely as inflation raises fears of an economic downturn. And the CEO of Tesla has a dire outlook. Elon Musk says he's got a super bad feeling about the economy, and he's reportedly ordered a halt to hiring worldwide, plus a 10% cut in the company's salaried workforce. But then the world's richest man gave contradicting messages on the potential reductions, sending workers and investors on a roller coaster ride. All this comes just days after he's ordered employees at both Tesla and his rocket company SpaceX to return to the office. Well, Tesla currently has about 5,000 job openings advertised worldwide and 100,000 employees. Demand for its cars and other electric vehicles has remained strong so far, but the company's stock took a hit since the billionaire used his shares to finance a planned acquisition of Twitter. Well, Musk's gloomy outlook echoes recent remarks from executives, including JP Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon and Goldman Sachs president John Waldron. Other companies have also cut jobs or paused hiring. American employers in the technology sector, they cut around 9 times more jobs in May than in the first 4 months of the year, while retail giants, including Walmart and Amazon, have said they hired too aggressively earlier in the year. But President Joe Biden says U.S. job numbers in May are historically robust and are one of the signs of a healthy economy. U.S. employers added 390,000 jobs, extending a streak of hiring. The figure has beaten forecasts for a 325,000 rise in new roles, but May's increase was the slowest for a year. The unemployment rate held at 3.6% for the third month in a row, and nearly every large industry added workers. One major exception was retail, which shed nearly 61,000 positions. And pay has been rising faster than it has in years. The average hourly wage rose to almost $32 last month, up 5.2% compared to a year ago. However, pay growth slowed in May for a second month in a row. Well, joining us now from London is Richard Siegel. Richard's a research analyst with the London-based financial institution Ambrosia Capital. Richard Siegel, welcome to the programme. Should people get worried when someone like Elon Musk says he has a super bad feeling about the economy? You know, one always senses he has an ulterior motive.
I think we always have to take it seriously when a business leader such as him has words about the economy which are on the outlying side. On the other hand, he does have a tendency to change his mind from time to time. So I think we should wait 2 or 3 months and see if he still has the same views as we end the summer and head into the autumn. But in addition, I think we should also listen to the views of some other business leaders who are looking at different parts of the economy and also have the pulse on it. Some, such as the leaders of JP Morgan, have the same views, but some have a much more sanguine view.
Do you think those changes of views? Sorry to jump in, but those changes of mind that you're talking about, are they kind of calculated? Is he trying to influence markets by doing it?
That I don't know. He does have a tendency for doing this in the past. He does have a reputation of trying to be provocative. But whether that is what he has in mind about this particular item, that I don't really have a strong view on.
As far as Tesla is concerned, what is the situation there? The demand for electric cars is still strong, isn't it?
Yes, it is very strong. And with oil prices as high as they are and possibly going higher and staying volatile, they will only increase over time, partly because of pricing, partly because of government regulation, but also consumer preferences. But at the same time, it is always natural for large companies to pause and assess their hiring. Hiring freezes, even in companies and industries which are doing well, are not unheard of, but it would be quite a surprise if any kind of pause in production were to be long-lasting. One of the advantages that Tesla has is in an industry where the lead times are very long to go start to finish, and building an electric car company is quite long. It's about 5 years, so there's a natural barrier to entry that a company such as Tesla has with a very good brand name, which is difficult to compete against. So in that context, I'd be very optimistic about Tesla long-term, even if the short-term is difficult to predict.
Right. There's a lot going on in global job markets, isn't there? Especially with as far as Musk is concerned, his decision to freeze hiring and cut jobs, and he seems to backtrack. There seems to be some sort of contradiction there.
Yeah, I would agree about that. But again, I wouldn't read too much into short-term developments because that is always natural. It could be that he's still facing some supply chain difficulties, and therefore job cuts could be a temporary reaction to that. But again, I'd be pretty optimistic about his industry longer term.
Right. But there are other employers, plenty of other employers who are cutting back. Netflix, Peloton, cutting back hiring, retail jobs are taking a hit too.
Yes, but those are different situations. With the example of Netflix and Peloton in particular, they made a couple errors of judgment and strategy. They, like many others, assumed that the shift in personal consumption from goods to services would be larger and more long-lasting, and that expectation was reversed fairly quickly. They were counting on too much growth. But at the same time, you can go start to finish with a streaming company in 6 to 12 months, maybe even less as the technology is advancing so quickly. And the technology of an electric cycle is quite simple. The barriers to entry are very low. But at the same time, with retailers such as Target, it's another completely different situation where demand is holding up pretty well. I'm not that worried about revenues, but they're being squeezed by margins because of higher than expected input costs, but also higher wage costs. So with a company such as Netflix or Peloton, I wouldn't be optimistic about them regaining their former revenue base. On the other hand, I think that a company such as Target, once the present headwinds have been worked through, I think they could recover their margins relatively quickly, meaning 6 to 12 months.
What about the situation in the United States? Latest jobs figures, President Biden says the jobs market is robust.
Of course, it's always the job of a president to talk up the economy, and particularly the jobs market, especially during an election year. However, on this, I would agree with him. The jobs market is very healthy. What does worry me, though, is that the labor force participation rate hasn't moved back up to where it should. There just isn't the supply of labor that will keep the economy going over the longer term. It does naturally self-correct. Those who are outside of the labor force typically are tempted in outside of the labor force for whatever reason. However, it's very difficult to predict how long this will take and if the matches in the correct industry will occur and how quickly.
Richard Siegel from Ambrosia Capital, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the world's 10 richest men have more than doubled their earnings since the global health crisis began, while the incomes of 99% of the world's population are worse off. The inequality gap is feared to get even wider as the cost of living soars. But new analysis says taxing the world's richest people could raise at least $2.5 trillion a year. That would be sufficient to lift billions of people out of poverty and make enough vaccines for the whole world. Organisations like Fight Inequality Alliance, the Institute for Policy Studies and Oxfam, they found at least 183,000 households own a combined wealth of more than $36 trillion. Another report by the World Inequality Gap says the richest 10% of the world population owns 76% of all wealth. A single person from the top 10% earns at least $122,000 on average per year, but an individual from the bottom half makes less than $4,000. And while global inequalities between countries have declined over the last two decades, income inequality has increased within most countries. The average income gap between the top 10% and bottom 50% has almost doubled. More than 150 millionaires called on politicians at the World Economic Forum in Davos last month to tax them more. The group, who are known as the Patriotic Millionaires, include the American actor Mark Ruffalo and Disney heiress Abigail Disney. Campaigners say a multilateral agreement proposing companies pay at least 15% tax on earnings didn't go far enough. Let's take this on. We can speak now to Dr. Paul Siegel. He's a reader in economics at King's College London and an economist researching global inequality and poverty. Thanks for joining us, Paul Siegel. As inflation rises, how much worse could this inequality gap get?
Well, the big problem with inflation we're having at the moment is that it's specifically hitting goods like food, which are particularly important for lower income households. So that's why when inflation goes up, it's not even across the board, and it's particularly hitting those on lower incomes. So what we're likely to see is inequalities probably rising as we speak, and it's going to continue to rise as this disproportionate increase in food prices and energy prices also proceeds.
So inequality is growing in some surprising places, isn't it? In Japan, for example, a country where most people regard themselves as middle class, the gap there is growing. Where else is it most pronounced?
Well, I mean, historically, the most unequal regions have been Latin America and sub-Saharan Africa. They're sort of famously unequal regions. But what's particularly interesting in the last couple of decades has been the progress that Latin America has made on inequality. And there, that really gives us important lessons for the rest of the world on how to tackle inequality. Because what we've seen in a lot of Latin American countries has been rising minimum wages, increases in transfers to low-income households, and also in a lot of countries, increased investment in education. And over the kind of medium to longer run, that's how a lot of countries in Latin America have managed to reduce inequality, really in a way that a lot of analysts didn't expect to happen at the time. And I think all countries can take heart from that, that if governments really want to tackle inequality, we have the tools to do it.
Right. So measures to redistribute the wealth. I mean, we got these programs in Japan, as a matter of fact, and China. Can they work?
Well, absolutely. I mean, so China is a particularly interesting example because China deals with inequality in a rather different way from a lot of other countries. They have the Common Prosperity Program at the moment, and they've had a lot of inter-regional redistributions in the past as well. And they're much more if you like, growth-oriented, where they're focusing on investment and improving infrastructure, particularly to help those regions of the country that have lower incomes. And China's actually been quite successful in slowing down inequality and then actually reducing it, not a lot, but somewhat, in the last 15 years or so. And that's through large amounts of investment in productive capacity and also administrative capacity in the poorer regions to ensure that incomes go up in those regions and helps them to catch up with the with the richer parts of the country.
It's interesting is that we have this cohort of people who've got a great deal of money, of millionaires who are asking for governments to tax them more, like Mark Ruffalo and Abigail Disney. Is that realistic? And in fact, why don't governments do that?
Well, it's certainly realistic. There's no reason at all not to tax very rich people more. I think the reason why governments don't do that in practice is that, I mean, while there may be some millionaires asking to be taxed more, I think there's probably more millionaires asking not to be taxed more. And crucially, and this is a very important point here, some of the very richest people that we have are billionaires who own large sections of the media. as you will understand very well. And those billionaires who own the TV stations and the newspapers, they very much don't want to be taxed more. And they have a disproportionate political power within the political system, and they can shape debates, and they can very much influence public opinion on these matters. So those relatively small number of very wealthy individuals are able to move the debate and change the political environment in a way that makes it much harder for governments to substantially increase taxes on the rich.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much indeed for that, Dr. Paul Siegel, speaking to us from London. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And that is our show for this week. If you'd like to comment on anything you've seen, you can tweet me at Nick Clark Al Jazz. Please use the hashtag AJCDC or just drop us an email. countingthecasts@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That will take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Nick Clark from the whole team. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.